April 26th. I'm Bart Gazzivi, and this is Scott Gans. We're from the FCIC. And we're here to interview Antonio Alvarez this morning from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And if the other participants from the Federal Reserve Bank could identify themselves for the record.
Shari Leventhal from the New York Fed Legal.
Stephanie Ruiz, New York Fed Legal.
Jennifer Schuster, Legal.
So, Antonio, I assume you know a little bit about the FCIC.
We
were created by Congress. We've got until December 15th of this year to finish our work and issue a report to the President and to Congress in the broad scope to explain the financial crisis. But there's a list of other tasks, including looking at the large institutions that failed and the large institutions that would have failed but for federal assistance. Obviously, Citigroup falls within that basket. So we've been interviewing folks from the OCC, the OTS, the Board of Governors, and last Friday and today, Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This isn't a deposition. It's not adversarial. It's me asking questions. I sort of, you know, I'm skimming on the surface here. You've been living this life with a Citigroup for a while. So it's important to me that if I ask a question that's not the right question, go ahead and answer it, but then tell me what the right question is, and then answer it. And, you know, if I ask a question that you don't understand or that Sherry can correct me on, then, you know, we'll hopefully get the record clear. That's all we're trying to do today. This is mainly an educational proceeding for us. So, and we're also covered by the same federal statute on that covers your work in the criminal code, that if anyone attempts to mislead us, it's subject to criminal penalties under Title 18. So why don't we just start with some general background questions. Why don't you tell me how long you've been here at the Fed?
Sure. I started at the Fed in 1991. I spent about 9 years working in the statistics function, which is part of research and statistics. I was a reports analyst, collecting, analyzing, and passing along the results of financial and regulatory to reports. I moved to bank supervision in 2000. In the year 2000, for about a year or so, I worked as a financial analyst covering a portfolio of Asian banks. Then in 2001, I moved to our core credit department, and I was there for 5 years. Core credit, doing examinations of banks, foreign banking organizations, and bank holding companies, looking at asset quality and credit risk management. Along the way, I got commissioned formal training as a bank supervision examiner, which is, you know, a generic training on the aspects of a safety and soundness examiner. Then in December 2006, I joined the Citi team as a credit risk coordinator. And I've been there since.
And as the credit risk coordinator, who do you report to?
I reported straight to Diane Dobeck, who was the central point of contact. While she was there, I think she was there until about May, I believe, more or less. And after she left, I reported to the Kathy Voigt, the deputy central point of contact. April, May, I'm not sure.
Sure, that's fine. So tell me sort of generally, as the credit guy starting in December 2006 for Citi, what was your portfolio? What was your mission?
Sure. A credit risk coordinator, the the mission is by working with a whole bunch of people, including people in the office, in the board of governors, the primary regulator especially, to be able to work with these folks to come up with our own views, our own assessments of the firm's risks and vulnerabilities. That's the mission, and we aim to do that by focusing on what's important, what the priorities are. When I got there in December 2006, the priorities were already identified: leverage finance, hedge funds, and Basel II, the related work, because Citi was embarking on work to qualify us for capital treatment under the Basel II Accord.
And by leveraged finance, can you explain what that term means a little bit?
Leveraged finance, leveraged lending, refers to loans to borrowers that are characterized by high debt-to-equity leverage, usually associated with buyouts, with leveraged buyouts, but not necessarily. Often, private equity firms such as KKR and Texas Pacific Group and others would want to take over a company and finance it with that. And banks, of course, are the major banks and broker dealers with the major lenders. Yeah. And the leverage finance could be loans or bridge finance, bridge the gap between from a particular point in time and when the capital markets are tapped, such as through a bond issuance.
So what did you start working on in December of 06 when you first came over to the Citi CPC team?
In December of 06, being new to the team and new to Citi, basically to just review prior work, to review audits, talk to folks, and to review internal MIS, that sort of thing.
So you'd look at the old examination reports, the targeted exams,
right.
Is there a continuous monitoring file with Citi as well?
Yes. Prior work that my predecessors had done, just try to review the last year or two of prior relevant work, including risk assessment documents that are done periodically, where my predecessors would assess the portfolio and take a look at the risks and so on.
And who was your immediate predecessor, if you know?
Boris Formasi.
So, do you know what document we're on?
I can figure it out.
I'm going to tell you myself. Hold on.
I guess that would have been the question to know.
34 or 35?
Yeah, the last one I have is 34, so I think you're up to 35.
Okay. So we've gone through a database that the Board of Governors staff made available to us that I believe is actually housed here.
Yeah, we actually made it available.
Good. Now I know who to ask when I have questions. So we've gone through some of the materials, and I'm just going to go through some of these documents in chronological order with you today. So the first document that I'll mark as F35 is titled Audit and Risk Review Report Special Review. Begins with Bate Stamp 892 up to Bate Stamp 900, and it's dated May 21st, 2007. Can you take a look at that and tell me if you've seen this document before?
Creditors Strategy and Planning.
Yeah, take your time. You've got a pretty thin pile, so you don't have to.
Right. Risk strategy and planning. Doesn't seem familiar. I'm going to take my time and read it.
Sure. The issues are very familiar, but the report is not. Okay, well, why don't you tell me about the issues?
Sure. Total rate of return swaps.
Okay. So tell me about the, if you don't recognize this memo, tell me about the issues that this memo brings to your recollection.
It's an audit that it's business issue. Okay. There's first of all, there's a range of findings that audit could have. A major business issue being the most severe, a business issue being being an issue also less severe. It's talking about GRR global risk reporting, which is one of the main database system where credit exposure is captured, and it's pointing out that there's some issues with the reporting of exposure, and in particular collateral, right? It doesn't break out collateral, and in some cases certain credit support.
So what were the major issues highlighted in that report?
The exposure on the credit programs not consistently. It's a reported in GRR. Also, the other main finding here is that there are issues reconciling finance and risk exposures and data. This has actually been a big issue. As you may know, Citi has been very decentralized with the build up through various acquisitions, and they have not done IT and systems well. They've just added systems and aggregated through less than efficient means. Actually, through other work, through later work associated with Basel II readiness, they've identified, Citi itself identified that they had major reconciliation differences between information that's used for financial reporting and information that's used to come up with MIS and risk management by themselves. At one point, the differences were huge. We've been following progress on this since pretty much sometime in 2007. A lot of this would be something as simple as a particular exposure that resides some information you need for financial reporting, some you don't necessarily need to get to assess the risk. If it's not properly mapped, then you're going to have a difference. And at one point, the differences were really large.
And explain to me what really large might mean with respect to Citigroup?
Billions, hundreds of billions,
hundreds of billions.
Yeah,
that's really large.
Usually it meant that you may overstate things too.
Right.
Citi, the main measure of credit exposure is a broad measure of exposure, a banking book type of measure that they aggregate loans, fund the loans, money out the door, commitments to make loans that only a percentage of it actually, history shows, gets funded. Except for some famous ones, and derivative counterparty exposure, which is measured through statistical techniques, advanced techniques, basically Monte Carlo simulations. The current exposure plus potential add-ons, and so on. So they had this broad measure that has its benefits and its negatives as well. This seems talks a lot about the structure of credit, right? The issues there are, they've just brought down the differences, say sometime in 2009, got to an acceptable level.
Okay. So, just to give me some background, when you say that the Monte Carlo method is used to measure exposures,
yep.
Is there...
For derivatives.
Right, for derivatives. Yeah. Because you don't know, sort of, it's not like a loan. There's not
right.
a... It can... The principal sort of can shift as
right.
the underlying index shifts. Is there some sort of standard template or analytical tool that the Fed uses to assess whether someone's Monte Carlo exposure limit applied to counterparties is adequate or not? So do you look at someone and say, okay, you know, they've done it to a X percent confidence level,
yep.
whereas the other guys do it to, you know, 99.5,
yep.
so these guys aren't good enough, or is there not any sort of one standard in that you just observe and don't try to put a floor under?
There are standards, and actually we did an exam in the middle of 2007, which was headed by Steve Mursky, which I believe you'll talk to him soon.
Next.
But basically, I had some involvement as well, and he was the lead examiner. Yes, there are standards. You measure potential exposure in what we refer to as loan equivalent, basically a statistical approach to try and estimate. And it's a rough estimate, mind you, of what the potential exposure could be. But basically, in that exam, we found that measuring techniques at Citi and other firms needed to be improved. Basically, there was a lot of trades, a lot of the complex structure, derivatives, exotic derivatives, that could not be measured in this Monte Carlo simulation, and it was measured in ad hoc processes. Some of them complex and maybe fine, but the problem was when you have a lot of these processes and you start adding some type of derivatives to measure this way, some that way, some that way, and you add it up, you don't, in reality, if it's the same counterparty and if it's subject to a legal netting agreement, you're really overstating the exposure. So the problem with overstating the exposure was as follows. If you overstate exposure, then it becomes meaningless, and the number doesn't mean anything, and it's not used to get to manage. So we were concerned that it was so overstated that it became meaningless, and you saw exposure that emanates from derivatives that are half a trillion or whatever. So what do you do with it? And how do you... manage against a limit when there's little confidence in the number. So the focus of that exam was to understand better exposure measurement. It's important to get to measure it right so you can take action against it and it can be meaningful and useful. Stress testing the exposure was also a key tool because whatever the exposure is now, if the underlying factors, whether they be interest rates, commodity prices, or whatever the derivative is linked to, small exposure now could jump. Right. So that was the other big aspect of it. And there was two or three other aspects. But the end result is that we issued a letter saying that they needed to rethink. Comprehensively to rethink the way they measure exposure. They needed to do stress tests and some other things.
So counterparty exposure, you know, obviously, so Goldman is a counterparty,
yep.
right? But what do you do from a credit risk standpoint when you're looking at special purpose entities or special purpose vehicles where there's some relationship that... could potentially have credit exposure for Citi? Is that considered a counterparty, or is there some other way of looking at the indirect credit risk in the relationships with special purpose entities?
Well, work around special purpose entities was not my main focus during that time. But as a counterparty, it depends what the terms of the transaction are. Is it collateralized? What's the quality of the collateral? I mean, basically, counterparty credit, if it's collateralized and you have tight thresholds, that is the main, you know, the main safeguard. That, for example, hedge funds. A lot has been said and written about hedge funds. Banks have suffered very little losses in dealings with them because they're tightly managed with cash collateral or cash equivalents. The same could apply to any counterparty. The potential risk and problem is whatever your exposure is now. If you have dramatic moves in the value, and if the counterparty runs out of cash, you don't have it. You could be out of luck, but especially when you have systemic issues.
Right. So when you're looking at trying to get a good idea of a net exposure by netting the outstanding transactions, do you look at sort of the family group? So, and that's my word. So for Lehman, it would be all the Lehman entities, or do you look at an entity by entity? So you look at the broker dealer, you look at the holding company, and you net with respect to each individual entity.
You got to look at it both ways, or actually, you got to look at it by legal entity because legally. The entity the city is doing business with, all those trades that are subject to a netting agreement or between the two legal parties to a contract. Since then, there's been a big push to consolidate and reduce the number of legal entities. Everybody wants to deal with the most higher credit quality counterparty, Citibank versus broker dealer. Right? Etc. But you want to look at it both ways, because that's often spillover. If one entity runs into trouble, maybe the whole bigger company will run into trouble. You got to do it both ways. But in terms of indirect, when you're looking at the exposure to Lehman, if you want to take indirect exposure and indirect risks further, if you have exposure to Lehman. In a way, you're also exposed to commercial real estate. Lehman had a big concentration in commercial real estate, and so if you think, if you look at it without that consideration, you could real estate prices and what happens in the real estate market affects your counterparty relationship.
Right.
With Lehman, that's an example. One that was most noticeable because it became apparent at a particular point in time that they had a lot of commercial real estate exposure. So this could be taken to that degree, and the more information a bank knows about the counterparty, then the better it is able to judgmentally. This is hard to measure from Monte Carlo or any other measurement, but it's also a lot of common sense, right?
Okay, I'd like to mark the next document, F-36, a memo to the file by Kevin Lee, dated July 11, 2007. It says it's meeting minutes, Bates numbers 887 to 891. Take a look at that. Let's see if that looks familiar.
July 11. Yep, the content is familiar. This looks like it could have been part of the examination of hedge funds and counterparty credit that I mentioned. It looks not 100% sure, but it's the right time frame when we conducted the examination. That was, again, headed by Steve Mursky. And it looks like it's looking at what audit looks at, and audit was the last line of defense. You know, the first line of defense is the business itself that takes on the risk. Then independent risk management that watches them, and here comes audit as the last line of defense, checking up on the checker. Right. So it's describing the protocols, the global credit centers. Global credit centers is independent risk. Thus, I think it's just cataloging audits that internal audit has done of this global credit center's entity, independent risk, and what they found in 05, they rated it as satisfactory. No, and they hadn't found any issues, major business issues. No. They found some business issues. Cover on some of the stuff. Stress testing, they've been weak in that for years. We had exams of hedge funds going back to several years some before and pointed it out. Once again, they're all rated satisfactory except for the one that was unrated.
And for the record, now you're on page 3.
Yep.
And what does EMEA stand for?
That's basically
emerging markets, Europe and Africa.
Europe, Middle East, and Africa.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically, a big chunk of the world, but dominated by Europe.
Right. Yeah. So it's, and my understanding is that the London offices is sort of where this is mostly headquartered. Is that correct?
They have global credit centers. They've since renamed themselves to Financial Institutions Risk Management. But because Citi has large operations, the broad independent risk is set up with people in New York covering hedge funds. Hedge funds are also very active in London and Europe at the time, so there was a set of individuals assigned to cover hedge fund activity that took place in Europe and UK mostly.
So, just looking at this page 3, it's a sort of a chronological flow, both for the Americas on the top of the page and the foreign exposure in the bottom of the page. And it starts off in 2005 with both the Americas and the foreign having a number of business issues. But by the time you get to 2007, there are no business issues noted in the foreign. And in the Americas, it says problem recognition credit risk and risk ratings credit risk. Can you describe?
Let me take a look at. Now, this is 2000. Field work was finished in June, but reopened due to the Bear Stearns event. Bear Stearns event, I It's probably talking about their two hedge funds that they felt that
the Bear Stearns Asset Management hedge funds.
Yeah, that they didn't get support. Once again, just I'll answer that question. But the content of this, when we were doing the examination to come up with our own views and assessments, one of the things we do is we look at relevant work that control functions such as audit does, and Kevin Lee working on the exam team was cataloging prior work and findings of internal audit so that we could use as background for our own work. Okay, this issue, I believe it dealt with when events happened. One of the things you can do is you could say, well, you could put counterparties in question or related counterparties on watch. You have concerns about a particular about hedge funds because of the Bear Stearns event. What's independent risk doing about it? Are they recognizing the problem? If you're recognizing the problem by monitoring it carefully, by taking a look at your legal documentation, making sure that the collateral is tight, and a whole bunch of prudent things that you could do, and you can also downgrade that particular counterparty. Say if they're rated a certain thing, you can downgrade it, and that's an indication. What audit found is that independent risk was low in actually pulling the trigger and downgrading the counterparty. Okay, that's what.
So let's take a look at that footnote 5. It says problem recognition with regard to subprime originators and investors in related instruments. Yeah. Do you know what that's referring to specifically?
Not off the top of my head, but you got to remember the time frame. This was after the fact. This was after the subprime blew up, or let me rephrase that. After the markets froze, they ended up blowing up later. But this is audit coming in with the benefit of hey, the subprime market is stuck. They're digging and they're finding issues. That would have been great if they found this before, but. Right.
So my recollection is that Citigroup had at least two types of business relationships with the hedge funds that were managed by Bear Stearns Asset Management, that they both sold CDO tranches of the CDOs backed by subprime mortgage-backed securities. And there was also a credit relationship that Citigroup had extended several hundred million in loans to those hedge funds. Was that, do you know, was that part of this review or was that part of your review at any point in 2007? Do you have a recollection?
It sounds they probably had a relationship. I don't recall specifically.
Okay.
Actually, that was the beginning of the subprime reason. There was a lot of focus on hedge funds. So I'm sure Citi's exposure to these two hedge funds and other hedge funds that had a subprime concentration would have been an area of focus. The specific details I don't recall.
Okay. And just for the record, that's your name on page
sure.
5 showing that you were attending the meeting, which sure. is referenced here.
Sure.
The next document, F-37, one page, Bates stamp 873. It's dated 7/12/07, which is one day after the last document. Can you just skim that
sure.
really quickly?
Counterparty exposure measurement. Agenda in advance of the meeting, similar to that, this had to be the exam that we conducted, and looks like it was the agenda that we forwarded that we might have sent to city in advance of the meeting. The first one, product capture. We wanted to understand the types of products the percent counterparty with the greatest difficulties to quantify. New product.
So does this look familiar?
Yes. I was involved in this exam.
Okay.
Yes.
So if you can explain a couple of things to me. What is wrong way risk?
Wrong way risk. It's one of the better names for some of the risks there, but that's basically your exposure to the counterparty grows at the same time that the credit quality goes down. Okay.
Sort of like a liquidity put, perhaps? Would that be an example of wrong way risk? If you had a liquidity put to a SPE that had issued asset-backed commercial paper, at the outset, the risk of loss on the liquidity put is viewed as de minimis, but then as the collateral in the SPE deteriorates and the counterparties refuse to buy the commercial paper, the likelihood of the liquidity put being drawn increases.
You can look at it that way. In the case of the liquidity put, the exposure was at $25 billion. That's what the guarantee, if you will, was. Just the chances of it being drawn.
I see. So it's not just the probability increases, it's the overall magnitude? Is that what a wrong way risk?
Right.
Okay.
With derivative counterparty exposure, the actual exposure, your claim or the firm's claim on the counterparty goes up at the same time that the quality. Take a monoline insurer, so for example. They insured a lot of CDOs, super senior CDO pieces, right? Counterparties, banks and broker-dealers that bought the protection from monolines, their claim on the monolines went up at the same time the value of the subprime assets went down, and because they had such a concentration, the credit quality of the monolines went downhill at the same time the exposure shot up. That was classic wrong way risk.
Okay.
Something that had been known and talked about. We saw it in action when the crisis took hold.
And what's can you explain number 9 to me as well? Evaluation of the sufficiency of the metrics.
Yeah, take it exposure as an example. Exposure metric, the actual exposure itself. You know, if you're overstating it, such as what we were discussing before, or you measure it accurately, or you overstating it, if you're overstating it or understating it, but you have a problem. Overstating it by a lot is bad too, for the reasons we talked about. It's the easy way out for firms sometimes get to say, oh, it's hard to measure, so we're going to measure it very conservatively and measure it to such a degree that it becomes unusable. So that's
okay. So the next document that I'll mark is F38, Bates 866 to 872, dated July 12th, 2007. And I believe these are minutes of the meeting that the last document referred to. Why don't you just take a brief look to see if you think that's accurate.
What do we meet? Okay, we met with some folks at Citi, the head.
I just want to see the
Sure.
Okay.
Did I not read those off? Did I forget to read those off?
I just didn't hear it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I think you read it, I just missed it.
So it was a meeting with the exam team, including the exam team's management, Jim Mahoney and company. And I was there, and Kathy Voigt were there. We were there to talk to the head of counterparty risk management at Citi, and other people at Citi in charge with measuring the derivative counterparty exposure. Okay, so let me reflect my memory. Just read the darn thing.
Do you know if you wrote these minutes?
No,
or
probably it was somebody. It was either Steve or somebody working.
Okay.
For Steve. When we do an exam, those of us on the on-site team contract that out basically to our risk specialists that are more subject matter experts than we are. More generalists with knowledge about this, but the exam team and his specialties, including quant-minded examiners, because you are looking. So they were leading the exam.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. The first issue here, product captured. Here it notes that for certain products they measure it through add-ons, what they called. I forgot what CES stands for, but it's basically measure outside of the main exposure engine. Okay, and Citi's saying, well, we add conservatism. You know, when in doubt, you measure the exposure more conservative, which sounds fine, except that if you do too much of this, you end up with
meaningless numbers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So this was discussing that, getting examples, and asking for some more information on that. I'm sure Steve could give you the gory details better than I can.
Do you know the sentence on the bottom of the first page, with respect to securities financing, concentrated positions in exotics were noted to be generally more difficult in modeling from a risk perspective.
Yeah.
Now, when it says securities financing, what's it referring to there?
It's referring to repos and borrowing of securities, that type of thing. Secure finance transactions.
Would structured products like CDOs fit in that basket?
No, I don't think so. This is basically the repo book and securities lending. That's
so,
I think.
So when it says exotics, what exotics are in securities financing then?
I'm not sure what that's talking about.
Okay. Fair enough.
Okay, new product incorporation. Okay, I believe when you have a new product, a new type of derivative product or secure finance transaction or a wrinkle on an existing product, it often requires some special thought to make sure that it's all the risks and the exposures being captured adequately. And I guess this topic was getting at what are their processes for coming up with a measuring technique and how you incorporate it into your overall exposure. Just going to give a brief overview of the process. They explain what the general process is to get to doing that. There's the wrong way of risk again.
It's big.
Yeah, it ended up being big.
So on the top of the page that's Bates 868, which is the, I believe, third page of the document, says currently the GCC produces two key reports, a credit trade report and a concentration risk report. Pertinent data from these reports is incorporated into the firm's hedge fund review reports, which filter up to management to Dave Bushnell. Do you know who David Bushnell is?
Yes.
Did you? Go ahead.
Yeah, he was the chief risk officer. So yeah, of course.
Did you have much interaction with Mr. Bushnell?
No. He left third quarter or fourth quarter of 07.
Yeah. And how about a woman by the name of B.B. Duke? Did you have much interaction with her?
B.B. Dukes and Pat Ryan were the co-heads of credit and market risk. B.B. Dukes was more of the market risk person. Pat Ryan, more credit risk. They had a dual role as co-heads. There was an effort there because of the interaction, credit risk and market products existence and traditional loan products, you know, in market risk existence and that type of thing. B.B. Dukes, I met for the first time during this discussions during the counterparty hedge fund exam.
So, going to the page that's Bates numbered 870, and looking under this number 9, evaluation of rigor / sufficiency of metrics, going down to the last sentence in that section, it says, two areas that Mr. Wayne highlighted that were particularly vulnerable to insufficient risk metrics were fixed income, exotics, and equity derivatives. And there are areas highlighted for future focus in terms of validation. Do you recall that discussion?
That particular, you got the details of that?
Do you recall what he was referring to when he said fixed income exotics?
I could speculate, but I'd rather not, because I really don't recall not all of the issues that we discussed in that exam and the level of detail and ones were to
some
subject.
Some things were your portfolio, some things were someone else's portfolio.
Or just when we're talking about validation, the validation that's done through statistical means or others of some complex or so-called exotic the products, when that happened, we brought in the big guns. We brought in the examiners with this type of expertise.
So going on to the next page under number 11, liquidity measurement for securities financing, and looking at that second paragraph. A broader question was raised regarding whether the firm has a formal systemic approach for identifying and managing concentrated positions. Do you have a recollection of what's being referred to there?
Allow me to,
sure.
to read the paragraph.
Just off the record, I think Steve will be able to answer lots of these.
Okay.
Yeah, I can. We can save that. It's better to save it for us for Steve. I have an idea, of course, but
okay. He's the, so July 2007 was sort of an interesting period of time. My recollection is that we've been told that's when the purchasers of the asset-backed commercial paper and the conduits first started telling Citigroup and the managers of the conduits that they would not be interested in rolling over the commercial paper. And so the managers of the various SPEs started calling Citigroup and informing them that the liquidity puts would be exercised if Citi didn't do something else, which I think they ended up taking a different approach than allowing the puts to be exercised. Did you have any participation in any of those discussions in July 2007 to September 2007 regarding the liquidity puts?
No, the super senior CDO positions, the liquidity puts, and a lot of other interesting activity were done by my colleagues.
And
Halsey and Kathy Boyds and those folks.
Who is the first? Oh, Bill Halsey.
Yeah.
Okay. Next document is F-39, and it's, again, a meeting minutes, apparently, Bates number 764-768, dated November 13th, 2007, re-exposure to monoline insurance sector.
That was probably me, and Glenn Ruffy, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Glenn and I did this. Okay, so we have all the monolines here, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have what Citi internally designated it as, whether it be passed or okay, or special mention. These are the regulatory designations you may be familiar with.
Right.
And we describe the type of exposure with loans and commitments to make loans being relatively small and derivative exposure being relatively large and growing. And then the total of this plus this is what they refer to as OSUC.
OSUC?
Yeah. Yeah. It stands for outstandings and unused commitments, technically, but it's this broad measure of exposure that includes stuff that originates from loans and derivatives, letters of credit. Well, loans and letters of credit and derivatives.
Okay.
Okay.
In the last column, where
indirect,
says, yeah,
indirect. Let me refresh my memory. I guess we're trying to look at the entire relationship with the monolines. That was the effort to see second and third tier type of relationships. If the monolines are in terrible, or some of them in terrible financial condition, to the extent that they provided guarantees on other business, such as the muni business that could, at that time, was a perfectly fine business, that could have some impact, and there was a way to try and to mention this and get our arms around that. So let's see. The direct exposure, the bulk of it was derivatives, and that did originate from the monoline's selling protection to Citi.
Credit default swaps?
Credit default swaps. Nope. We talked about that. Very little direct or traditional loan exposure. Okay, the bulk of the indirect was associated with the muni business, as I alluded to. Yep.
And what's this phrase? Citigroup's liquidity commitments to their own multi-seller ABCP conduits in which the monolines provide asset reps for the underlying assets in the conduits. Is that referring to the conduits that have corporate credits underlying them or conduits that have the CDOs, or do you have a recollection?
It's probably later on in the memo. It's
okay. Well, why don't you
that the stuff associated with the super senior CDOs would be in the credit default swaps would be in this column here. This $5 billion.
Yep. But my question was the ABC conduit. So why don't you read or skim the memo, read it, and let me know if you know.
Sure.
Which conduits that was referring to?
Indirect. Doesn't specify it here.
I can't say for sure. So you don't have a recollection or anything?
I suspect it's their credit cards, Citi's credit cards are student loans, those types of retail assets that they finance through a balance sheet activity, and they issue ABCP from that, but I don't know for sure.
So in looking at this and thinking about this, you don't have a recollection of looking at asset-backed commercial paper issued by conduits where Citibank had issued liquidity puts and the conduits held super senior CDOs?
No.
Okay, no. The next document is one that's previously been marked as F20, Bates 732 to 746, discussion read, Citi. Why don't you take a quick look at that?
January 2008, John Lucco. This we were preparing, I suppose, for the annual assessment that we did in the first couple of months of 2008.
And did you participate in that process?
Yes, I would have. Every member of the city resident team would.
Well, can you describe that process to me generally? Is it like a big group meeting where you all sit together with the CPC team leader? Is it a bunch of one-on-one meetings? Is it a bunch of memos flying back and forth?
What many meetings.
many meetings.
I mean, it starts out with with each of us that are responsible to, for a risk stripe, coming up with some preliminary views. We would engage our specialists in the office that specialize in certain risks. We would talk to the OCC, since most of credit exposure resides with the National Bank. It's the primary regulator. Their findings, if available in time and finalized, would be a significant input into our decision making. If it's not available, we would talk to our OCC colleagues and try and get a sense of as to if they have any firm findings that they can share. And then we would come up with drafts, preliminary thinking. We sit together and try and compare notes. We think this applying to these products. Bill Halsey has thoughts about the stuff that it covers, et cetera, et cetera. And we try to come up with themes, with assessments that cut across that are important and cut across the whole firm, as opposed to. So we start. It's like almost like a bottom-up approach. Then we would engage with other people that are involved in supervising city, and it's a lot of people that have their hands on it. So that process would go on for a couple of weeks, a couple of months.
So do you recall January 2008 what your focus or what your piece of
would have been? My focus would have been leverage finance and just general corporate credit and derivatives as well, taking with the work that we did over the summer, all the relevant work, and trying to put it together to come up with an overall assessment.
Yeah. And why don't you tell me about leveraged finance. My understanding was, in addition to sort of acquiring stuff for their own portfolio, that they had, for lack of a better word, a leveraged loan pipeline they used to create CLOs. Is that?
They were involved in CLOs as well, I believe, and they were involved in total rate of return swaps as well. But by far, the biggest pipe that the business was to originate loans with the intention of selling them through primary or secondary syndication, and to retain as little as possible.
Okay.
Unfortunately, for them, they made bad choices. They got into the they hit the accelerator. In the first half of 2007, when the market was already heating up, and they hit the accelerator towards the end, that proved to be a bad decision on their part. They got when the market dried up and they couldn't syndicate it anymore, they ended up holding about close to $90 billion in leverage loans that were highly concentrated, poor underwriting with poor underwriting, highly leveraged. It was bad business. Yeah, they thought they could sell it. Chuck Prince infamously said, "Well, dance until the music stops." You might have read that,
right? Yeah. So, in looking at the risk management. Yeah. Of that business, in our review, we've seen that the original limit was $35 billion on leveraged loans. They increased to $50 billion and increased it then again to $100 billion within a 1 year time period.
The big increase happened at the end of March. There were a lot of large deals that were coming that they wanted to participate in, and the big increase happened at the end of March of 2007.
Right.
Citi had been focused on one aspect, mainly on one aspect of the leverage loan business, that was the bridge book. Could the bridge book is higher risk in the sense that it's unsecured and as opposed to the loans, the leverage loans that are secure usually by the assets of the company and other things. Citi had been focusing on this aspect of the leverage finance business and reporting it up the chain in board of director MIS reports. They had increased the limit on that subsector of it to $20 billion in the first quarter. And that they kept their eye on. But on the other part of it, the larger piece that were also risky, they hadn't been focusing on that because they thought they could sell it, right? So that was a pretty big miscalculation.
So if that happened in March 2007, yeah. Do you know when either you or anyone else at the Federal Reserve Bank became aware of the increase in the limit?
We were aware of the increase in the bridge finance limit to $20 billion. It went up to $20 billion at the end of March 2007. In April or May, several days after the Board of Directors met, committee of the Board of Directors met, we reviewed the MIS regularly, and we took a look at what was being reported out up the line. That was basically Dave Bushnell and company highlighting to the board what's really important. Around that time, that we had become pretty concerned about the leverage loan business because it had been growing in 06 and it was heating up in 07. We knew that there was a large pipeline of announced deals that hadn't settled yet, and we had been coordinating to do work around it and get our hands around it, some careful analysis. One of the ways that we would do this is through annual shared national credit exams, right? They begin in April. They end in June, July. One of the focus of that is industries or types of loans that we're more concerned about. Leverage finance and CRE are old favorites. We've always been concerned about that.
And by CRE, you mean commercial real estate?
Yeah, so shared national credit is shared by the major regulators for Citibank and other large banks. So it's led by the OCC, the Fed and the other, and the FDIC and the OCC are involved in selecting the sample of loans. We collect loans. We select a sample, again focusing on non-investment grade, industries of concern, and so on. Because the leverage finance, there was a lot of deals announced. A lot of it wasn't captured in the exam because, in order for a credit to be a loan to be classified as a SNC, it needs to have three U.S. regulated lenders, okay, and a lot of these loans didn't have that. Basically, when Citi or other banks, when they issue a commitment to make a loan, they issue a legal document saying Citi, which they define as any bunch of possible legal entities, makes a commitment. The borrower will accept it when they have the deal done. They wait because they don't want to pay the fees in between. And sometimes it could be quick, a month, sometimes it could be a year, but depending on whatever hoops they need to get shareholders in the company to approve the acquisition. Once it became apparent to us that the SNCs, the usual way to learn and can assess this wasn't going to yield fruit, we set up an effort to engage the other regulators, broker dealers. The five broker dealers have become major lenders. There was a lot of change happening in the leverage finance business. CLOs and hedge funds were big investors, and this was a change from 5-10 years ago when the main investors were other banks, smaller banks, and institutional investors such as insurance companies, etc. So we were engaged in this process, and this process took a couple of months, where we set up a process to collect the same type of information from the major banks, bank holding companies. This kicked off in July of 2007. At that point already, the subprime market has ceased, and the leveraged finance market follows on after.
So I think you sort of answered when you became aware of the underlying exposure increasing.
Yep.
But I'd also like to know if you did become aware personally of the actual increase in the limit, or would have that been that like an operational risk guy or some other guy?
No, that limit increase, I didn't become aware of that until the summer.
Okay.
And for the reason that it for such a big increase in exposure, it wasn't captured in the key MIS. City.
And by MIS, you mean Management Information System?
Yeah. In the key reporting, Citi was my kind of focus on the bridge aspect of it, and did not thought to highlight that in their reporting guide to senior management. We did not become aware of that until the summer.
Okay.
So we were aware of the leverage finance part of that part of the book, and we, as I said, we were getting ready to do some coordinated careful analysis. As concerned as we were about the market, I don't think that we were going to put the brakes on it without doing careful analysis and without reaching consensus and engaging the other folks. The other regulators that had a stake in it too.
Primarily the OCC, or would it have involved?
The SEC also.
The SEC?
Yeah. The five broker dealers were major lenders as well.
So turning to the page that's marked bait stamp 737, it says potential magnitude of the market risks assumed in CDO structure. Structuring, leveraged lending, and structured conduits were not adequately understood by businesses or independent risk function. So you would have had input on this comment with respect to the leveraged lending, right?
Well, the yes. Well, in the case of leveraged lending, we believe that they understood better risks. That leverage lending was some of the riskier lending. It always had been susceptible to a downturn in the economy. They misestimated their ability to syndicate it to distribute it. It was a big miss, of course. The problem. It wasn't so much of a risk aggravation as just understanding that a big pipeline of leverage loans, if you get stuck with it, you have significant losses, right? It was less about aggregation and more about actually identifying the risk and giving it the attention.
Okay.
And I think this document just just about an accountant was a preliminary effort at getting our arms around the issue that would be finalized in several versions later, and it resulted in a MOU being issued to the city several months later.
So the next document I'll mark is number 40. And it starts with bait stamp 718 and goes to bait stamp 729. It says outline of discussion with city senior management, April 11, 2008. I'll just take a look at the front page and let me know if this is something that
I was involved.
Yeah, that you would have had input on with respect to your areas of coverage.
Certainly would have had them involved in helping to prepare this. I was not involved in the actual discussion with city manager.
Okay,
so risk management. Exposure to subprime mortgage and CDOs only indirectly through the monoline connection.
Right.
Leverage finance, of course, yes.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and skip to page 4, which is bait stamp 721, and take a look at the leveraged lending bullet.
Yep. The pipeline or the exposure grew very fast, true. Yep. Underwriting standards were diluted in the industry and city specifically as well. They had the belief that they could syndicate it, sell it.
So the three main bullet points that I'll just paraphrase are that the underwriting was diluted, the pipeline expanded, which is that reference to the $35 billion to $50 billion to $100
billion. Yep.
And they basically relied on the belief they could sell it.
Yep.
So looking back on the problems that arose from the leveraged financing, obviously, you know, it would have been better if city management had understood the potential risks of a liquidity freeze in the syndication.
Yep.
And had constrained their activity. But assuming they hadn't, what systems could the Fed or the OCC have had in place that would have more effectively limited the exposure of city to this type of a problem?
Well, going back to that particular period of time, I mean, we're talking about the first half of 07, the economy was growing. There was a lot of liquidity in the market. There were signs, and as I mentioned, there was work done around the Fed in our banking trends and analysis and other places pointing to markets overheating. It became much more apparent as time went by the first quarter of 07. There was something that the market was heating up real fast. Underwriting standards kept deteriorating. This was not good. We were concerned. Within a couple of months, we set up a work program to collect information from the other from the major players, asking similar types of questions to assess what should be done about it, because the market had changed tremendously, the leverage loan market. We needed to get the other people involved, the SEC and the OCC. And basically, once we became really concerned about it, within 2 months or so, we set up a program. Granted, 2 months may seem like a long time when you're sitting on a ticking time bound, but we didn't know that at the time. Later on, when concerns about Contagion and this market under severe stress and that market under severe stress, what took us 2 months or so to get organized, to talk to the other main players involved, we did it in a couple of days as opposed to 2 months. I guess what could we have, well, have we been able to read the future and know that that there would be the beginning of severe systemic problems? I'm sure with the benefit of hindsight, we will react this sooner to try and put the brakes. But at that particular point in time, it's hard to see how you could have tapped the brake hard with the information that we had and period of time that we were operating under.
Well, when we interviewed Alan Greenspan before his testimony, he basically said that nobody can predict the future and that the only effective means to prevent catastrophes are to increase capital requirements and increase liquidity, because when you have problems, then you'll have the means of dealing with them.
Sure.
But is there anything else? I mean, you know, one of the things you've mentioned is that, you know, you want to make sure that you were coordinated with both the OCC and the SEC before anyone started tapping the brakes. If you had simply one regulator for a very large financial institution instead of functional regulation, would that speed up the process of making these sorts of decisions?
Theoretically, if you assume that that would speed up the communication and decision making, maybe you can also do it by being on the same page. And I think it was done subsequent to the crisis when everybody was concerned. Cut decisions were made a lot sooner. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I don't have any more questions, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to say something for the record. If there's something that you think is important, a lesson learned that we should take into account when we're writing our report, this is your opportunity to say what, instead of the questions, could discern what you think is important and what you think needs to be taken as a lesson from this entire episode.
I'm fine. No comments.
Okay.
I think it's fine.
All right. Well, it's 10:45, and our interview is concluded. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.